Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Then, rising very gradually and wiping his two eyes, Lord Brahma looked up at Mukunda. Lord Brahma, his head bent low, his mind concentrated and his body trembling, very humbly began with faltering words to offer praises to Lord Krishna. Here's the purport. Brahma, being very joyful, began to shed tears, and he washed the lotus feet of Krishna with his tears. Repeatedly he fell and rose as he recalled the wonderful activities of the Lord. After repeating obeisances for a long time, Brahma stood up and smeared his hands over his eyes. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that the word lochane indicates that with his two hands he wiped the two eyes on each of his four faces. Seeing the Lord before him, Brahma began to offer prayers with great humility, respect and attention. Om Ajnana Tamarandasya Ginandana Shalakaya Chakshurun Malitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I thought I'd begin by discussing ecstatic symptoms, because Lord Brahma is exhibiting a lot of ecstatic symptoms. Who can tell me three ecstatic symptoms that he's exhibiting? Tears, yes, tears. Trembling. One more, I see. Faltering voice, yes. So, those that are acquainted with the nectar of devotion will know that ecstatic symptoms are many categories. There's what's known as the sattvika bhavs. They act directly on the elements of the body and bypass the intelligence. Then there's the anubhavs. They are subsequent ecstasies that come about from other ecstasies. And then there are vyabhichari bhavs or sanchari bhavs, which means they come and go. There's many of them, I think it's 30 or 31. But the sattvika bhavs, how many are there? I've asked this before. Ashta sattvika bhav. Eight. However, there's a little caveat here. There's nine for vatsalya ras. What's the ninth? It's come up. It's shedding of milk from the breast. So if you're in Vatsalya Ras, there's a ninth sattvika bhav. So the three bhavs mentioned in this verse, now I know that they are sattvika bhavs. Whether there are also other bhavs, that might be the case. So I'm not going to say exactly what they are in the case of Lord Brahma, but shedding of the tears, that is one of the Ashta Sattvika Bhavs. And it occurs when the life airs interact with the water element of the body. Water, water, makes sense. I mentioned perspiration there because I was thinking about the fire element. When the fire element is affected by the life airs in the ecstasy, then you get perspiration. Now, one of them is being stunned. Now, trembling's mentioning. I'm thinking now. Is trembling one of the Ashta Sattvika Bhavs? I was thinking stunned is actually... No, wait. I think it is, actually. Anyway, when the life airs affect the earth element, one may be stunned. I think that's what gives rise to trembling as well. And then when the life airs give... I'm not going to say what it means for gadgada, faltering of the voice, but I know it is an Ashta Sattvika Bhav. I don't know which element it is. But anyway, it's all very interesting. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because the next verse we're going to discuss, well, I won't discuss it, but will be Srimad Bhagavatam 111. Right? So what does 111 have to do with Ashta Sattvika Bhavs? Well, there are many commentaries on the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has given around seven interpretations of that one verse. We know that Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati lectured for a long time on that one verse in Dhaka and was very much respected by the public because they could understand his great learning. Now, Prabhupada said, he said it was 3 months he lectured. In the book written by Bhaktivikaswami and also in Rupa Vilas Prabhu's book on Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, they both say 1 month. It doesn't really matter, but anyway, the point is, as a verse, it has vast scope for discussion. Therefore, 1 month, well, that's not enough. There's one Prabhupada lecture where he says we could give 1 month lecture on every single verse. So then he asked his disciples, so how long would that be? And it works out at, well, someone started figuring it out. So that's, you know, 18,000 verse. And then if you do a month on each verse, someone actually calculated it, so it would be like a huge amount of time. Not possible within one lifetime, definitely. Anyway, so one of the, now, if probably, I was offered to give class on 111, but in a few days' time, but because I'm working, I said no. But there's one very interesting part of the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which can be discussed in terms of sattvic abhavs. And that is the phrase, you probably heard it, Tejo Vari Mridam Yatavinimayo. I'm not going to say the rest. That's the phrase. So what does it mean? It means, well, I actually think the Muyanti Yatsuraiha, it's about bewilderment of the demigods. But they get bewildered because this material energy is so bewildering that sometimes air, sometimes fire looks like water, water looks like earth, and so forth. For example, if you're in a desert, you might see a mirage. So it's earth looking like water. Sometimes in fire, if you look at fire, you see these little movements that look kind of like water. So all this transformation, that's the bewildering nature of this material world. And that's the primary meaning that's given in the translation. But to give a different meaning, Teja can mean the fire element. Vari means the water element, and Mrida means the earth element. Therefore, what it's actually being referred to is when the devotee is in ecstasy and he's undergoing these various sattvika bhavs, then there's all these transformations. So the air, water, fire transformation is actually indicating the ecstatic symptoms of someone who is on that platform. And if you know the third verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, Nigama Kalpa Taro Galitam Phalam Bukha, Sukamukha Damrita Dravasam Yutam Pibata Bhagavatam Rasamalayam Mahurahu Rasika Bhuvi Bhavukaha, that the Rasikas and the Bhavukas, those who are qualified to enter into the deep rasa of Srimad Bhagavatam, they will relish it over and over again. So if we read Srimad Bhagavatam and we are qualified, then we will have these symptoms. Therefore, Tejovari Mridam Yatavin No Mayo will have another meaning for us. It's a nice, it's a lovely description. I'll give you another meaning of this. When Krishna plays his flute, what happens to the water in Vrindavan? It freezes, or not freezes, it becomes solid. What happens to stones? They melt. There's an example. If I prepared for the class, I would have told you the fire example, but I don't remember what it is. The point is, the elements change when Krishna plays his flute. So if you're on that platform, if you read Tejo Vari Mridam Yatavinimayo, you're thinking, in Vrindavan, the water turns into solid matter, the stones melt, that's where you're at, you see. So there's many different meanings to the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. I'll tell you one more. The treatment, Trisarga Amrisha. Trisarga means the three creations of this world. And Amrisha, Prabhupada says, almost factual. It means it's false, it's also true. It can be either meaning. So, the standard explanation we get for that verse is that this transformation, which is very bewildering, we understand from this that actually the material world is almost factual. It's not real. In the sense of ontologically speaking, it's real. It's the energies of the Lord. But in terms of the appearance, we know it's not real. And that's what it means by Amrisha, if you can see it that way. But here's another meaning that Vishwanath or it's Jiva Goswami in the Krishna Sandarbha, because they both discuss this verse. I think it's Jiva Goswami. He says, Trisarga means the three creations of Srimati Radharani. So what are the three creations of Srimati Radharani? She's known as Angshini, the source of all Angshas. So what's her name? What are the three creations of Radharani? The three categories. Think of Shakti Tattva. Where do Krishna's pastimes take place? They take place in Vrindavan, they take place in Dwarka, and through his Narayan expansion, they take place in Vaikuntha. So what is in Vrindavan, what are Radharani's expansions? What category? Who are they? Who are Radharani's expansions in Vrindavan? They're known as Kaya Vyuha. Think of the verse from the Brahma Sangita. Ananda Chinmaya Rasa Pratibhavita Bis. You know this statement? what's the next line? Ananda Chinmaya Rasa Pratibhavita Bis. Tabirya Eva Nicha Rupa Taya Kalabhi Galoka Eva Nivisatya Kilatma Bhuta Govinda Madhi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. The Govinda, he eternally resides in Goloka with Nija Rupataya, his counterform, Radharani, and Kala. Kala means the expansions of Radharani. So who are the expansions of Radharani living in Vrindavan? And it's a very simple question, so I think you're all just deciding to let me answer. No one wants to say? The gopis, right? It's obvious, right? So the three creations of Radharani are the gopis in Vrindavan, the queens in Dwarka, and the Lakshmis in Vaikuntha. So what this verse is saying, when we say Tri Sarga Amrisha, it means that Radharani makes the three sargas, the three other creations, Amrisha, almost false or insignificant. So the actual meaning is Radharani is so dear and so amazingly important in the eyes of Krishna that in comparison to Radharani, the gopis, the queens of Dwarka and the Lakshmis are insignificant. But of course we know they're significant because they're in connection with Radharani. Okay. So that's a little bit about how the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam connects to this verse, because it's in connection to Ashtasattvika Bhavs. Now, my favourite chapter of the 10th canto is the 14th chapter. I don't mind my own business, so I sometimes have opinions and I like to influence what goes on at the manor. So I wrote a few emails a few months ago and said, I think we should go back to the first canto when we finish Prabhupada's purports. Not because I think the other purports aren't wonderful, but because personally speaking, I think some devotees, they want to hear Prabhupada purports. I know a devotee that regularly comes here who gets very upset if someone gives a class and does not read a purport of Srila Prabhupada. I also know people that sometimes if they want to give a verse on a special occasion, they choose the verse they want, and if there's no purport, they read a purport of Srila Prabhupada's because they feel it's the right thing to do, because he's the founder of Acharya, it's his temple. And I think based on that, I think it's a good idea to go back. Fortunately, from my point of view, the people I wrote the emails to agreed, and also back to Rasamrita Maharaj agreed, so that's the way it was. And then I said, afterwards I heard, and I thought, thank you very much, Nandan Prabhu. Well, he's Nishkinshana Chaitanya now. Then I said to him, by the way, do you know this first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam? It's so full of things to say, and the purport's so long that maybe we should have the first verse for, you know, several days. And then he did, thankfully, he decided. Which is why, after this, when we go to the carry on the Bhagavatam classes, we'll have nectar, lots of nectar, because there's so much nectar in the first verse, and it'll be split up, the purport will be split up in sections, and different speakers will speak on different parts of that purport. So I'm very happy with that personally. Unfortunately, I won't be present for most of it, but I will be planning to download so from the internet so I can hear what other people have to say about this famous verse which was spoken on for either 1 or 3 months by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. But because the 14th chapter, in my opinion, is in some ways the best, in my opinion, it's the most significant chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially from a epistemological point of view, meaning what is real knowledge. There are two paths. One path is called the Aroha Panta. You never knows what that means? You can say what the Aroha Panta is. Ascending, yes. It means you start off with nothing and you construct your knowledge. And the other path is called the Avaroha, which means descending. So the lesson to be learned from Lord Brahma's pastimes is that the ascending process doesn't work and the descending process is higher and can be understood. And if you study the 14th chapter, you'll see many verses that indicate this. One is, Jananta eva janantu kim bahukcha name prabho manasho vapasho vaibho manasho vapasho vacho vaibhavam tavagochara. Lord Brahma prays to Lord Krishna. Some people say they know you, Krishna. Let them say that. As far as I'm concerned, I do not know you, because you are beyond my mind, manasa, my body, vapusha, and vacha, my words. So Lord Brahma realizes that the person he's trying to analyze by stealing the calves and seeing how he reacts is actually a greater being than him, and he's out of his depth, and therefore what happens? He apologizes and he becomes humble. So this is an example of understanding that the ascending process of knowledge does not work. And humility is very much part of this verse, because we have the term prashraya van, very humble, and we have the verse, the statement krita anjalihi, means with folded hands. So this is the humility of Lord Brahma. And when you're humble, then you receive the mercy of the Lord. And what happens when you receive the mercy of the Lord? Atapite deva padambujadvaya prasada leshana grihita evahi janati tatvam bhagavan mahimno nachanya ekopi chiran vichinvan. Also from verse the 14th chapter. That if we get a little fraction of the mercy of the Lord, then we can understand tattva. We can understand the truth about Krishna. Whereas someone who is vichinvan, a scholar, he cannot understand even after a long time. So that's another example of the rejection of the ascending process and the acceptance of the descending process. And also from the 14th chapter, Shriya Shritim Bhaktim Utasyate Vibho Klishyanti Ye Kevala Bodha Labdhaye Dishana Sau Klejala Eva Shishyate Nanyadya Tastula Tushava Gatinam. That if you give up the path of Bhakti, which is known as Shriya Shriti, the path of Shriyas, Shriyas means our ultimate benefit. If you give that up and you practice Kevala Bodha, logic without devotion, then your endeavors are worthless and stupid, just like trying to beat the empty husks of rice. You're not going to get any more rice out. It's a waste of time. So Prabhupada would often say the education system is the slaughterhouse. It makes you into an ass. He also said, and when you get your piece of paper, you have to go go from one employer to another and beg like a shudra for a job. Now, it's interesting, I watched the little video clip of David Cameron glorifying Prime Minister Modi when he came to Wembley. Remember that? And he was glorifying him. One time he said, India is a place of opportunity. Here is the Prime Minister, he was a chaiwala. Now he is the Prime Minister. And he was glorifying the way that we can, in India, they can transcend their caste designations. He can go from chaiwala to Prime Minister. And then he started talking about, and he's going to be promoting all these universities of technology. And you think about it, it's obviously going to happen, because Indian people are very good with technology. You go to Bangalore, they're all got these computer heads, and that's what they think about. And they all want to go to Bangalore. I remember one time when I used to live in Calcutta, and then this Calcutta girl, she saw me in the internet cafe. Actually, I was in Mayapur, and I started doing my emails. And then she started, "Are you from ISKCON?" So I started talking, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And then before you know it, she'd come to Mayapur, and she was looking for me, and she wanted to marry me. Oh my God, what did I do here? And her father was totally against it. Her father was a millionaire. I found out after I got married. Anyway, it wouldn't have made a difference. But the point was, she said, at one point I got engaged, and then she wrote to me, "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, we never arranged anything, and I've hardly even spoken to you, and you said you were off to Bangalore," because she was off to Bangalore. Her father wanted to send her to Bangalore, because people want to send their children to Bangalore and get an education. So I said, "You're off to Bangalore." Anyway, she said, "Well, I would have just given up the Bangalore idea. Didn't matter." Anyway, the point I'm making is, David Cameron, he's glorifying India for being a place of technology. So what does Srila Prabhupada say about technology? He calls it Shilpa Naipunya. It means expertise in something that's very low. So the Prabhupada gives an example. The intellectuals, material intellectuals, are like vultures. Does anyone know this analogy? Can anyone explain this analogy? Why are material intellectuals like vultures? I'll tell you why. A A vulture has got very, very good eyesight. Just like an intellectual's got a very good brain. But a vulture's business is very low, to find the stinking, rotten corpse. So in the same way, if you have material intellect, but your business is to stay on this low material plane and you cannot elevate your consciousness, you're like the vulture. Your taste is very low, but your ability is very high. And what do we care about? We don't care about ability, we care about taste. That's what matters. A Shudra can go back to Godhead in this life, shown with Shudra consciousness. In fact, I think it was Bhakti Rakshat Sudramara said, it's actually a very conducive consciousness for devotional service. Why? Because you're already the servant. If you're a Brahmana, Kshatriya, or Vaishya, you might be proud of your position. But if you're already the servant and you come to devotional service, then what are you going to do? You're going to serve. Shuddha Bhakata Charana Renu Bhajana Anukula. What's the next verse? Bhakata, what's the next part? Bhakata Seva Paramasiddhi Premalatikara Mula. That if you serve the devotees, that is the prema latika mula. It is the root of prema. And when, was it Gauranga Prabhu gave class? He said, he made an interesting statement which made sense, but it was very unusual. He said, the Yuga Dharma is, what did he say? Vaishnav Seva. Did anyone remember that? And he said, because if you serve the Vaishnavs, you'll become humble. And then, Tranadapi Sanichana Tarareva Sahishnana Amanina Manadina Kirtaniya Sadahari. If you serve the Vaishnavs, then you can perform the Yuga Dharma. Therefore, without service, without the humility, you cannot even perform the Yuga Dharma. So in that sense, I understood it to mean that's why Vaishnav Seva is the Yuga Dharma. So I can kind of go along with that to some extent. So where were we? I was talking about the vultures. Yeah. So David Cameron, his vision is, it's wonderful that India is becoming one of the leading places in the world for technology and opening up all these centers for technology. So then my thought was, hold on a minute. The Prime Minister should be establishing Varnashram in India, right? And given his particular angle, he's into protection of cows. He's very much friends with ISKCON. He's also had been in other ashrams, but he comes from that particular angle. He respects Hindu Dharma. He likes Hindu Dharma. There, my comment, if I were there, of course, I'm not going to be able to speak to him, would be like, technology is for the Shudra class. We need to train up Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas. I wasn't planning to give a class on Prime Minister Modi, but I'll say one more thing. From what I've understood, he's pro genetically modified crops, Monsanto. From the point of view of a Vaishya, I think that is a very bad idea. It's not the natural way to farm. So I respect his protection of cows, but the other part of his policies, they seem to me that he is compromised by this material world, as is inevitable. Now here's a question, and it's a very interesting one. And Prabhupada disciples asked this question to Prabhupada. They said, this Vaishnav culture is perfect. Why did Krishna allow the Muslims to take over India and oppress the Vaishnav culture? It doesn't make any sense. Why would he allow that? People are doing things the right way, and Krishna's obliterating the whole thing, causing oppression. Anyone like to offer an explanation? Why would Krishna would not protect his divine Varnashram culture, his divine Vaishnav culture? Yeah. Yes. Thank you very much. You've actually given the right answer, because that's what Prabhupada said as well. He goes, no, you did not practice. They did not practice it properly, and therefore they were defeated. The Prabhupada is making is, if we follow our own culture properly, Vaishnava culture, we're strong. Our strength is in we follow our own. Krishna protects. There's a statement, Dharma Rakshati, Dharma Rakshita Rakshati, or is it the other way around? Dharma Rakshita Rakshati. Anyone remember that statement? I don't know which way around it is. It means, if we protect Dharma, Dharma will protect us. So if you want to know why sometimes elements of Vaishnav culture get oppressed by other cultures. And it's, they're not following properly. That's the actual understanding. Hare Krishna. Anyway, Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki, Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanumana Ki, Shri Shri Gonitai Ki Jai. Anyway, returning to the 14th chapter, I was going through some verses that were glorifying the descending process. And one of them that is Gunatmanas te pi gunan vimatum hitava tyanasya ka isharishya kalena yairva vimita sukalpai vipunksavaki mehika jupasha. Lord Brahma tells Lord Krishna, the scientist may calculate the number of snowflakes, the number of particles on it, or dust particles or atoms of the earth, or the number of luminaries in the sky, but they will never be able to calculate the number of qualities that Lord Krishna has. So Krishna has this name, Guna Atma. It means he's full of all qualities, and it's unlimited. So because Krishna is unlimited, the attempt of Lord Brahma to understand Krishna was doomed to failure, because he didn't have the sufficient intelligence to do so. And one other verse, Jnane Prayasam Vidapasya Namanta Eva Jivanti Sanmukaritam Bhavadiya Vartam Stane Sitashitagatam Tanuvan Manobe Ye Prayasho Jitatito Pyasitais Trilokyam. If one just gives up this process of jnana, the process of ascending knowledge, and instead hears from the lips of the pure devotee, then one will actually come to the platform of pure devotional service, and one will conquer Krishna, even though he is unconquerable. Krishna is known as Ajita, right? He's unconquerable. But you will conquer him, because there's something that will conquer Krishna. That's Radharani, or Bhakti Devi, Bhakti Shakti, which is the expansion of Radharani. So, if you haven't read the 14th chapter, I would suggest you read them. These verses, some of these verses I quoted, they're often found in Srila Prabhupada's books, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. The associates of the Lord sometimes quote these verses. For example, Gopinath Acharya, he quoted this when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was unable to recognize Lord Chaitanya. We were talking about ecstatic symptoms, right? Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya could see the ecstatic symptoms, and yet still he could not understand that these extraordinary symptoms can only indicate that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He did not understand. So, and he said, you know, the Lord is Tri-Yuga. He only appears in three yugas. This cannot be the Lord, right? So Gopinath Acharya, he said, this verse, Atapiti Deva Padambujadvaya, he said, if you receive the mercy, then you can understand the truth. But if you don't receive the mercy, then even if you're like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, you will not understand the truth. The same with Keshava Kashmiri. All these great pundits. So many, some were being mentioned recently. I forget which ones. Anyway, these are just some thoughts. And I'll finish with one little challenge for us all. We are seen by a lot of people as irrational people. We're irrational. Devotees of the Lord are irrational. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is a cowherd boy with a flute and a peacock feather. That's not a very intelligent way to understand God in a lot of people's eyes. We have this concept of elephants, you know, picking up, you know, tigers. Elephants, flying birds that pick up elephants. We have birds that drop eggs that kind of hatch as they're falling. We have like souls going through entering drops of water and then entering into crops and into semen and stuff like that. It's crazy stuff. Who would actually believe that, right? We have a golden mountain, you know, Mount Meru, which we can't see, but we believe it exists. You know, we have, our books talk about a flat earth and a round earth, and we can't figure out which it is, and we can't even figure amongst ourselves which it is. We are a society which don't even understand our own books. And then we're building a big temple in Mayapur to show people what the universe looks like, and we can't even agree amongst ourselves what it looks like. I mean, what chance do we stand from a rational perspective? So what do we do? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That will solve the problem, because you won't understand it through the process that Lord Brahma used. Actually, we just want to engage people. If people say we're stupid, we would rather people say we're stupid than they don't know we exist. Prabhupada used to count the number of times Krishna was in an article. If he saw an unfavorable article, and it had lots of Krishnas, he would say, that's a good article. If he saw a favorable article that didn't mention Krishna, he said, that's not so good. It's the duty of the intellectuals within our society to engage in a dialogue with the rest of the world to try and establish that we are in fact rational. And if they think we're irrational, at least they're thinking about us. They're thinking about Krishna, and that will gradually act. Because we want to give Sangha to people. And Sangha doesn't mean just, you know, on the street to everyday people. It also means Sangha to the intellectuals, Sangha to the leaders of this world, which is what Prabhupada was doing because he was qualified. And that Sangha should also lead to stimulating thoughts. When we meet people, we can say, you're nice, I'm nice, shake your hand, here's a Bhagavad Gita, see you later. Then we can put it on our Vaishnava website. Look, so-and-so met the queen, the king, or whatever. That, or a prime minister, that's very nice, but it's not enough. We want to be engaging these people. We want to be getting these people to think about what we are saying. We have answers. We are not happy with the way civilization is now. We have a say. We should be taken seriously. And that's what we want to be doing. We want people to think. You know, in our society, in this country at the moment, people are thinking a lot more about Islam than they are about Hinduism. Why? Because it's a problem for some people. There's a problem of integration. We want to be in the consciousness of the people. We want people to think about Krishna. We want the materialist people to think about Krishna all the time. So many people talk about Islam nowadays because it's a problem. Integration, it's in politics, it's in Germany right now. There's some German advertisements which are very disparaging to the Islamic perspective. But a lot of Germans like it. Therefore, they like these adverts because it's politics. So a national influence within German politics is becoming prominent. And a lot of people are scared. They think this is like Nazism coming again. You know, people are talking about we should have Germans only in Germany and this kind of talk. This is very... It's on the minds of people in the world. The thing is, we need Hare Krishna to be on people's minds. So we need to engage in the people in such a way that they actually are thinking about what we're thinking. And that requires us to become qualified, to present something which on the superficial perspective is very irrational and try and present it as the ultimate spiritual science which contains all other sciences, including politics, including material science, which is... Was it Shilpa Naipunya, includes technology, all these other divisions of knowledge, they're all within the framework of overall knowledge. And the word for knowledge is Veda. Veda doesn't only mean spiritual knowledge, Veda has its material compartments, but they are understood in conjunction with the ultimate center, and that center is Krishna. So we need to try and teach the world how to understand the various branches of knowledge in the context of the spiritual signs that we are presenting to the public, Hare Krishna. So thank you for your time. We have a few minutes left. Good. 5 minutes left. I don't have anything else to say, so please think of a question if you don't have one. And I do. I always think of one, so you can too. Thank you.
I will first... it's not a challenge.
Yeah.
How you personally reconcile these few statements you said about... irrationality of our philosophy, and what you feel in the heart, is that true for you, or is the irrational stuff true? Yeah, how you feel in your heart about that? Like, is for you also something which you doubt?
Okay, what do I agree? A lot of things written in the Srimad Bhagavatam, I do not understand what they mean. I'll give you an example. A lot of the Prabhupada talks, sometimes he talks about the earth being a globe or a ball or things. And other times there's descriptions in the fifth canto about the earth being flat and things. So I don't personally, I know a lot of friends who discuss this on Facebook ad infinitum, and that's one of the things I've avoided, because I have discussed it a little bit. And all I notice is that there is a problem of how to resolve it, and I don't know the problem. But I accept that there is a truth, and I just don't know what it is. See, there's different ways. Some people, if when they see a contradiction, they think that means what the Vaishnavas are teaching is wrong, right? Other people will say, it's a contradiction and I don't understand the contradiction. Therefore, I have to pray to Krishna, I have to become qualified, then it will make sense. So in situations where I don't understand, I take that option. I think, well, it has a meaning, it's there for a purpose, I don't understand it, and therefore I just have to ask others, and if I can't get the answer, I pray to Krishna, and I just wait, and time will tell, you know. But actually, how is the universe constructed? You know the story of how, I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of the Vedic planetarium, but there was a period, and when Prabhupada was here, he sent out some of his disciples to find scholars from other sampradayas to give them a description of the structure of the universe. Now, here's a controversial thing, potentially. I listen a lot to Prabhupada conversations. And at one point, he says, I am a layman on science. When I listen to Prabhupada speak about science, and I listen to Sariputta or Swarup Damodara Goswami, I think Sariputta and Swarup Damodara, they talk the scientific language more so than Prabhupada. And Prabhupada here says, I'm a layman. What does it mean? My understanding, you can have your own understanding if you like. Prabhupada would often say, what does it mean to be omniscient? It means to know everything your spiritual master knows, to know the spiritual science. Now, the material science is unlimited. You know, we've seen in the last 100 years it's growing and growing. So, is it necessary for Prabhupada to know everything about quantum mechanics, relativity? It's not necessary because it's the external science. Prabhupada himself says it's like hypnosis. If you enter into the scientific material science, it's like hypnosis. You get more into it and you spend your... My father's like that. He's now almost 80. And he's got this theory about how to unify quantum mechanics, relativity. He's like, and I think, why are you doing it? I said to him, look, if you look at scientists, the vast majority of scientific discoveries were made by scientists in their 20s. Quantum mechanics, relativity. Einstein was 35 for general, and he was about 25 for special. But usually, after a certain age, nothing happens. And he said, no, you have experience if you're older. You can unify. So he's going around for decades, because he retired for about 20 years. And he's been doing it about for 20 years, and he just gets into it. It's his little Rasa. It's going nowhere. I can see he's not going to become the next Einstein, but for him, he likes it. So this is the nature of a material thing. So when Prabhupada says he's a layman, it means I don't involve myself in a field of knowledge which is going nowhere and which hypnotizes me unlimitedly. That's how I understand it. So that's, I'm bringing this up in relation to why, what is it, what do we understand by not knowing everything? Yeah, I was talking about the planetarium, that's what I meant. Prabhupada said he didn't know how exactly to create the planetarium. So he sent out his disciples to various experts, and they didn't know either. Then after Prabhupada left the planet, someone found some saint from another Vaishnava, some village, they found some kind of diagrams of how the universe is in some village, and it was a saint from another tradition, and that became kind of newsworthy to the extent that people like Dhanavir Goswami or Sariputta would talk about it. And I don't know exactly to what extent that these diagrams were employed, but I'm just pointing out that there are aspects of our culture in terms of understanding the exact meaning of the fifth canto that even we don't understand. And it seems from Prabhupada's discussion that Prabhupada was looking elsewhere for an answer. So we have unlimited knowledge and we can't understand it. Prati shloki, prati akshari, nana arta, koya. Bhagavatam, every sloka, every verse has newer and newer meanings. So we're in an unusual situation because on the one hand I've been criticizing ascending knowledge, but then there's a type of bona fide ascending knowledge where you study philosophically, how is this true, ask other people. That's also ascending knowledge. It seems to me that the Vedic planetarium that has been currently built has been built on ascending knowledge. There are so many intellectuals who have got involved and they've argued and debated and they've come up with some solution. That was done through the ascending knowledge. But it's a different type of ascending knowledge because you're taking real authority as your evidence, and your reasoning is Shastra Yukti, it is based on Shastric principles of reasoning. Therefore, there is I wouldn't call it descending or ascending, I don't know what to call it. I wouldn't know how to categorize it. It could be ascending in the sense that if you do it sincerely, the realization comes. Descending, so anyway, Hare Krishna.